Buongiorno, benvenuti a questo incontro di Milano Tecnologia. Sono Juan Carlos De Martin, docente al Politecnico di Torino, nonché curatore insieme a Luca De Biase di questa manifestazione. È con grandissimo piacere che ho il compito molto semplice di introdurre un ospite d'eccezione e poi di gestire qualche domanda alla fine, domanda che potrò porre io, ma che arriveranno sicuramente tramite la chat che è di fianco al video che state guardando. L'ospite è Frank Pasquale. Professore di diritto alla Brooklyn Law School, collegato con noi dalla Corea, se ben ricordo. Benvenuto, professor Pasquale, è un piacere averla qui con noi. Dico due parole di presentazione. Allora, con Frank Pasquale, che è un grandissimo studioso di diritto, che ha collaborato con commissioni parlamentari, con la Commissione europea, con moltissime altre istituzioni, vi dico la cosa che più mi ha colpito personalmente, cioè il fatto che come studioso di diritto riesce non soltanto a far capire le questioni giuridiche, ma anche a integrare le questioni giuridiche con una comprensione della tecnologia importante e non solo quello, ma anche una comprensione degli aspetti economici, politici, sociali. E quindi, partendo da una sua base di competenza giuridica, riesce a fare un discorso che in realtà riguarda tutti noi come cittadini, come interessati al mondo in cui viviamo. Questo era assolutamente chiaro nel suo primo libro, The Black Box Society, la società della scatola nera, potremmo chiamarla, dove metteva in evidenza come gli algoritmi, un libro del 2015, ma era già chiaro allora come gli algoritmi avessero un impatto molto grande sulla nostra vita. Ed è sicuramente di nuovo lo stesso approccio che sta seguendo nel suo nuovo libro, che è appena uscito, quindi non ho ancora fatto in tempo a leggerlo, che è Le nuove leggi della robotica, pubblicato da Harvard University Press, e che arriverà, spero, anche arriverà in Italia prossimamente. Un libro dove, di nuovo, partendo dall'evoluzione dell'intelligenza artificiale, della robotica, cerca di affrontare in una maniera non soltanto accessibile, insomma, a un cittadino interessato, ma anche appunto integrando saperi differenti. Quindi è con particolare piacere che accolgo Frank Pasquale a Biennale Tecnologia, lo ringrazio per essersi collegato con noi e per il tempo che ci dedicherà. Grazie molte.
You're very welcome, Juan Carlos, and it is a real thrill to have this opportunity to reach such a distinguished audience and to be introduced by you. And I am pleased to announce that new laws of robotics will be translated into Italian and published, I believe, by University of Louisa Press in March of 2021. So relatively soon we will have translation, and I'm thrilled to have the work available in that way in Italy. I will now begin my presentation and share my slides for today, and I'll move to and so hopefully that works well for everyone. And this is a presentation on the book New Laws of Robotics for the Biennale. And just to start out with, one of my goals here. I think it's important to situate a book like New Laws of Robotics in a broader discourse about automation. And I think if you look at the books on the left-hand side of my slide here tonight, or today, there's several that are predicting very severe and rapid disruption by artificial intelligence and robots of so many aspects of life. The assumption behind much of this work is that just as robots came to the manufacturing field and revolutionized the production of goods, that robots and AI will next standardize and automate the production of services in so many areas. And what I'm trying to do in New Laws of Robotics is to join a smaller, but I believe more valid set of social science and legal researchers who say that ultimately what's really going to happen here is that we're going to be making a difficult choice as a society about where we want AI and robotics to increase the value of human labor and where we want AI and robotics to substitute for current workers. And that's a really tough choice, right? Because there's going to be some people that are going to, I think, gain a lot and properly gain a lot from the development of technology to help them. And there'll be others that will be, their jobs will be endangered or will disappear because of AI and robotics. So today's talk, I'm going to start by describing that divide. And then I'm going to make the argument in New Laws of Robotics about what type of general principles, echoing Isaac Asimov's Laws of Robotics, could be put in place in order to make the transition toward a more productive AI-driven, robot-enhanced future, if we are able to implement them. The fundamental divide I develop in the book is between artificial intelligence and intelligence augmentation, and I certainly am not the first to have come up with that. It was a staple of the intellectual history of AI and robotics since the 1960s. Intelligence augmentation is could be defined as using technology to add to and to enhance and increase the degree of acuity and intelligence people bring to their tasks. AI could replace them. And I think that in several areas, AI should be replacing current workers or could easily do so over time. Those include things like mining, right? A mining, whenever you have difficult, dirty, or dangerous work, it would often be best to have a robot or AI doing that work because we don't want to endanger people in it. With communications, logistics, again, putting up telephone poles, I don't see something essentially human lost when robots put up, say, telephone poles or dig minerals from the earth, as opposed to having human beings do it. In that respect, my approach is in some tension with Matthew Crawford's and others who try to develop, and perhaps even Richard Sennett, who try to develop a craftsman, sort of artisan point of view about lots of forms of manual labor. But I worry about romanticizing it, and so I don't go in that direction in my book. Driving is a classic example, and here we have the soon-to-be ex-president of the U.S., Donald Trump, sort of having fun pretending to drive a truck. And I think that this driving is an area where there's a lot of enthusiasm for automation, but also a lot of cautionary tales because, you look back even discussions 4 or 5 years ago, there was an assumption that driving would just be an easily computable problem, but it's not. It turns out to be much more difficult than many AI designers expected. And I think that some of the same difficulties that have come up in driving are also going to come up in some other fields. But just to review the paradigm cases for rapid automation, and what I've pictured here, this is the Baxter robot, which the mode of this robot is that it watches what people do and it imitates their action, right? So it can watch people take these gears on the assembly line and then simply place them into the assembly line in the same way in which a person does, right? It doesn't matter what the person is thinking. It doesn't matter what the judgments are of the individual about the nature of each one or the size of the box. All that matters really is being able to mimic their action, right? And in fields like manufacturing, logistics, transport, mining, and agriculture, I think that could be the case. I think that could be the case in terms of some medical testing, although there was also some anxiety over the past few months when a robot was introduced for COVID testing. And people were saying, well, if this malfunctions even slightly, that could lead to very bad outcomes in terms of how far back they put the swab in some people's noses. And so you have to have a lot of worry about how far you take automation into services fields like medicine. Because, for example, even something that may seem as mechanical as a COVID test, there might be many judgment calls to be made by the tester about exactly how much the person can stand, et cetera, as they're a sample is gathered. Moving beyond medical testing and gathering of samples for individuals, here is where I really want to make the case for intelligence augmentation. Because medicine in general is more than pattern recognition, stimulus, and response. We hear a lot of people in the disruption school of AI, people who think that things need to be disrupted, that there needs to be rapid change in fields, say, you know, all that being a doctor is just recognizing patterns and deciding what a certain pattern of input is, what disease it is, and then having an output be some treatment for that. And there certainly are going to be a lot of richer results from the lab, other sources that need to be integrated into a coherent picture of a patient's state of illness. But overall, even in fields that seem like they are merely pattern recognition, like radiology, dermatology, the study of the skin, pathology, even there are often judgment calls that have to be made. And we get lots of breathless headlines, enthusiastic headlines saying artificial intelligence now is as good as a radiologist at detecting cancer. But what they don't often tell you is that the study that supposedly says AI is better in general was only testing some small, very narrow set of pattern recognition. And so that's where my idea in the book is to reverse the goal, or to end the goal, of having a robot doctor replacing doctors, and just to recognize that really what the AI and robotics is often about is error reduction. It's about trying to reduce errors and to avoid preventable mistakes, okay? And that means the technology is going to be complementing professionals instead of substituting for them. This leads in turn to my four new laws of robotics. And so, you know, the model of robots sort of overwhelming us is one of, you know, substitution, people just being told to leave the job, you know, the machine's taking over. But in so many human services fields, that's not really optimal for anyone. It's not optimal for the workers, of course, and it's not even optimal for those that would supposedly be better served by robotics. And as I have reflected further on that problem, I developed these four new laws of robotics, and I should say that these also reflect consensus AI guidelines in many fields, or in many governmental institutions have articulated consensus guidelines. But a lot of times these guidelines are relatively lengthy and they're written in formal language, and I think it's helpful to sort of boil these down to a simple four, right? So if we were to think about four new laws of robotics, the first that I articulate is complementarity, that in professions, intelligence augmentation should be the technical aim, not artificial intelligence. And I think that I draw the line there with respect to professions, because I want to have a line to draw. Remember, I had the slide about the places where I think there's going to be rapid automation and that's justified, and that not too much is lost in it, like in manufacturing logistics. I think the jobs where something is lost can broadly be called professions, where a profession is a type of labor where there's a bargain. Society allows the professionals to set some of the terms of their own work, to say, for example, that before you become an attorney or an educator or taking on other roles, that you have to have a certain level of education and prove yourself in certain ways. And this bargain is really critical, because I think that the future of work is going to lie in types of work where the people who do the work can say, this is complicated, and we need to be given autonomy to study how best to serve those who we are serving, right? And this is something that I think is behind, ultimately, whatever autonomy we give to professions, unions in services fields, is this idea that their ability to make judgments outside the bounds of corporate control or even governmental control will be better for all of us, because independence guarantees better judgments. To complement that first new law of robotics about complementarity, I also say that robots should not counterfeit humanity. And what I mean by that second law of robotics is that there are many, it's has two prongs, I would say. One is don't deceive, right? There should not be bots that are calling people or robots that are calling people and pretending to be other people. And that prospect was raised by the Google Duplex Assistant. There was a assistant shown where you could just type into your computer, make me an appointment at the hair salon next Wednesday at 2 p.m. And the Google Assistant would simulate a human speaking, trying to get a reservation, right down to ums and ahs and the type of filler that we make conversationally, right? And I think that's troubling because I think it's deceptive. But even more than that, I think that many of the more ambitious projects to create affective computers, emotional computers, emotional robots, are machines taking over functions that really should only be left to human beings. The expression of anger, the expression of sadness, the expression of joy, of hope, all of those things, I think, when it comes to embodied interactions with entities around us in our space, should only be the preserve of human beings. And I say that, and I use the counterfeiting metaphor, because I think that the robotic simulation of all of those emotional responses is ultimately a fakery. And it reminds me of the fakery involved in money printing, where if there's lots of fake money, lots of counterfeit money, the real money loses its value. And similarly, if there's lots of faked emotions, lots of faked human empathy or pleas for help or whatever it might be, that devalues genuine emotional expression or genuine appeals for help, assistance, whatever it might be. So those first two are essentially industrial policy, trying to shape the AI and robotics fields in certain ways. There's many examples in the book of the types of particular hard law in taxation, in licensing, in reimbursement for medical procedures, and school funding and other areas. There's all these concrete examples of how we want to use the law to develop better robots into the future. The second two laws of robotics, cooperation and responsibility, those are primarily aimed at stopping bad things from happening. The first two are aimed at promoting a certain type of robot. The second two are aimed at stopping bad things from happening. And so one of those is cooperation, saying that we should not have arms races, zero-sum arms races, where the race for technological development is not increasing the pie of resources. It's not increasing the general amount of resources, but it's just about rival claims to existing resources. And that is most clearly the case in the case of killer robots, right? Nobody really gains if the U.S. next year makes 10,000 killer robots, and then China makes 15,000, and then the U.S. makes 30,000, et cetera. No one really gains from that, except for, I think, the people at the very top of those societies who are able to boss others around because they can have so much technology that they handle. But that's not robotics meeting real human needs. And that's where I think legislating against arms races or finding ways of discouraging arms races is a great first step toward reallocating talent in the AI and robotics field toward meeting actual human needs and away from just trying to help one person or another take a bigger share of a given pie of resources. And then finally, the fourth new law of robotics is responsibility and attribution. The idea behind that law is that any robot or bot online or AI online should have an identifying mark that allows us to trace that AI or robotics back to its owner. Okay. So I think that's really critical because there are so many financial vehicles now out there where people can hide their money, can do nefarious things with funds. And that's all predicated on the money not being traceable back to anyone. And what I deeply worry about is a future where drones might fly outside your window and you might never know, who was flying outside my window, who was recording what I was doing in my home. sidewalk robots might move around with impunity and block the way and trip people. And then what happens if, you know, there's no way of finding where the sidewalk robot came from, et cetera. And so these, and bots online are another example that is just so troubling, because you have literally thousands or tens of thousands of bots pretending to be people distorting the public sphere, right? And there's been so many studies of these bots distorting the public sphere. And some rejoinder is that, or some downplay this problem saying, you know, it's just a bot. I mean, who cares? It's just speech. But once you reach a certain critical mass of the bots, they do distort the public sphere and they do drown out people. And so in that way, you know, this responsibility principle ties in together with the cooperation principle when it comes to bots online. You both want to stop people from having arms races of speech emitting bots. And you also want to have people take responsibility for whatever bots are out there, so we can understand who owns them and punish people if they are misused. Attribution is really key to a particular person, because we know how to punish people for bad AI and robotics, but we don't know how to punish AI and robots. It's just, we can't. It's what do you do? You know, and I recently did an interview for the magazine Commonweal, where I described what it would look like to try to punish a robot. And to make a long story short, it's almost impossible to imagine, right? But we can punish people who own robots if those robots get out of hand. One of the dichotomies here that I think is really critical is the distinction between AI governance and algorithmic accountability, and also governance of artificial intelligence and governance by artificial intelligence, right? And my main premise of the book is that if we don't start to more aggressively govern artificial intelligence through entities like privacy commissioners, National Institutes of Standards and Technology, health agencies, et cetera, if we don't try to govern artificial intelligence, we will be increasingly governed by artificial intelligence. And we already have that in, for example, credit scoring, where a person's eligibility for a loan is algorithmically scored. We also even have it in the context of red light cameras. You know, in terms of red light cameras, there are, it's just automatic. If you go under the red light camera and the light is red, you get a ticket. And there's no real excuses made for that. And of course, sometimes it's going to be a good thing, right? I mean, both in terms of avoiding biased police personnel and also in terms of more perfectly enforcing the law. On the other hand, you know, we have to think deeply about how far we'd want to lead our laws to be like red light cameras, where you do something wrong, then you're just automatically punished. In thinking about algorithmic accountability in medical AI and robotics, I think there are going to be at least two waves. Okay, so I've talked a lot about AI as error reduction, and I think a first wave will involve improving the accuracy, fairness, safety, and efficacy of our current and developing technology. And I'll give a couple of examples in dermatology, in learning healthcare systems, and robot surgery. But the second wave is questioning certain trends in health technology, such as comprehensive surveillance tools, which could be surveilling, you know, they could be for very good purposes, like trying to all doctors wash their hands before they go into a patient's room. But on the other hand, this can become somewhat unhuman to have that type of always on surveillance of whatever you're doing. Also, I think slightly inhuman, and going back to the work of Joseph Weizenbaum, is automated therapy, right? Telling someone, you're not really important enough for a person to talk to, but here, talk to this app on a phone, right? That is another question, trend we might want to question. And finally, robotic caregiving. And I think that this first and second wave is really helpful in sorting out the policy implications of AI and robotics, because the first wave we have a lot of already. If you look at the Fairness and Accountability in Machine Learning conference that's been happening over the past several years, there are a number of very good scholars who are doing this first wave work, and it's critical work. But I also think that it has to be complemented by the second wave, which is to question certain trends in health technology altogether. I don't necessarily want to buy into a world where we constantly are improving robot caregiving. I think a better world is one in which we ask, how do we make sure that the persons who are to give care to the vulnerable elderly are properly supported by technology, rather than how do we replace those people with technology. Just to give a quick example with respect to error reduction in medicine, this example is from Eric Topol's book. And I should say that the book itself, New Laws of Robotics, the second chapter is on medicine, but there are chapters on education, journalism, the military. There's material in the book on policing, on the arts, on many aspects of AI and robotics. So I'm going a little deep into the medicine side here today, but rest assured the book itself has a much wider range of human services professions that it looks at. And the example I want to give here in terms of reducing errors in AI, which in turn reduces errors among physicians, is you could have databases in the future that will always be a second backup for, say, a dermatologist. Okay, so say you have someone looking at your moles on your hand to say, is this a cancerous mole? Occasionally dermatologists miss them. And so there's a lot of enthusiasm for technology that can do that job and it's on its own and can back up the dermatologist. But the concern comes in that the extant databases, the databases may not have enough representation for minorities to match their performance at diagnosing the most common skin type. And so our question is, what if such data becomes available and is an add-on, but the dermatologist failed to detect a malignant could have been detected with the additional training set, okay? And there, I think that the question of how much we demand of new technology and how fast we demand it be fully representative of society becomes a very important one. One legal principle that could come out of, that could help guide this from American courts is this case called Thompson v. Neeson, which talks about a hospital's duty, and just because I don't have that much time left, I'll just say number four here, a duty to formulate, adopt, and enforce adequate rules and policies to ensure quality care. And I think that's where we are with a lot of error-reducing AI and robotics, that we're going to need to formulate policies that will make this error reduction software and AI as accommodating and as representing as many groups in society as possible. I also just briefly want to say that, you know, if we were to compare two models of robotics deployment in education, one thing that I think is worth contrasting is the idea of the robot as a plaything or as something that is just, you know, that a child interacts with as a toy, and some efforts to make a robot teacher that would demand a certain level of attention, or perhaps to robotically project images of teachers to students. And I think that there's a lot to be said for going very slowly here, for decelerating, for slowing down the adoption of robotics in education until we have, you know, a really robust commitment to valuing the teacher's role as someone mediating between students and technology. So, you know, I have no objection to, you know, having terrific lessons embedded in robotics and AI. I'm sure that robotics and AI will bring an incredible array of learning opportunities to students, but I always want to see a person, a teacher, a qualified professional, a domain expert, standing, if not between the students and the technology, at least advising students and advising parents on both the strengths and limits of technology. I have a few examples with respect to journalism that I think are useful and I can go through relatively quickly, but just to say that, you know, these bots like on Twitter are really distorting the public sphere, which is quite destructive. And just to sort of skip down a little bit, I think that third-party fact checker features that we've seen also in the wake of the 2020 election, they were failing in the 2016 election, they're not really working that well. And ultimately, what we have to do is we have to restore more human editors to news sites, to big platforms like Facebook, Google, in order to ensure that technology here is not replacing journalistic and editorial expertise, but is instead supplementing that critical role for society. And just to conclude for today, I think that the key thing that I wanted to recommend to everyone is that sometimes we get the idea from AI discourse, everything, all tasks are reducible to data patterns that are reproducible by machines. And I don't think that's a scientific argument, I think that's ultimately a political argument, to put AI researchers in charge of the future development of healthcare, education, etc. And our goal needs to be distributed expertise, cooperation between AI researchers and domain experts, teachers, doctors, journalists, lawyers, all these different human services fields. I think that that really is a humane future for labor, which involves many professions, many people in many different walks of life and work, having the capacity to understand and to fully realize their own human capabilities, while also representing us and representing our needs and hopes as we are forced to increasingly, and both as we both are forced to and as we both reach out to, engage more with technology over time. And I really appreciate your attention today. And I hope to, hope to have a good conversation and further engagement on this work. So thank you.
No, grazie molte al professor Frank Pasquale per questa sua splendida esposizione dei temi principali del suo nuovo libro, Le nuove leggi della robotica, che abbiamo appreso dalla sua stessa voce che uscirà anche in italiano nei primi mesi del 2021, un'ottima notizia. Mi permetto di fare un primo commento io. Il primo commento è il seguente. Libri come il suo sono un contributo molto importante nel pubblico dibattito, nello spazio delle idee. Dal suo punto di vista di un cittadino degli Stati Uniti d'America, le sembra che queste posizioni così condivisibili stiano uscendo dal pubblico dibattito tra intellettuali, tra cittadini interessati e stia arrivando a influenzare il mondo della politica o siamo ancora in una fase precedente?
It's a very important question. And I think that on my account of artificial intelligence policy, we do need to do a lot of work as activists, writers, attorneys, intellectuals, to dramatize the problems that we see in algorithms and AI. And I think that the key to that is to have easily understandable, straightforward stories about persons who have been hurt by AI. And that, I think, fits in very well with my first wave of algorithmic accountability, the ideas about fairness and bias. I also think that we need to start having broader conversations about where society is going to be in 10, 20, or 50 years, right? We need to have that sort of broader scope. And something, and I know there are many points to critique within the Chinese governance system, but something that I think is relatively helpful as a guide for much of the rest of the world is a very long-term perspective on planning. To say it is part of the ruling parties or the rulers' obligation to try to develop a vision for what society will look like in 2030, 2040, 2050, and beyond. I remember seeing one AI report from Japan that had projections about population in 2150. And if we are able to have substantive discussions about that long-term vision, both on a national and a global level, that's going to be, I think, the foundation for a much better public dialogue about AI.
Connessa alla domanda che le ho appena fatto, a parte il livello nazionale e sicuramente gli Stati Uniti d'America per il ruolo che hanno a livello mondiale, ciò che capita in quel paese è particolarmente importante anche per tutti gli altri, l'Europa inclusa, ma pensa che possano avere un ruolo anche istituzioni sovranazionali? E penso per esempio alle Nazioni Unite che sono attive nell'ambito per esempio del controllo del cambiamento climatico, ma potrebbero avere un ruolo anche per avere una normativa armoniosa a livello internazionale su questi temi che abbiamo discusso, oppure andando verso una costruzione, come dire, istituzionale più articolata, l'Unione Europea sta provando a muoversi in questa direzione, adottando alcune misure e magari forse potrebbe, come le sembra ciò che è stato fatto a livello di Unione Europea fino adesso in questo ambito? Grazie.
Yes, that is very... very important perspective in all of those areas. And by the way, I should, before going on, I should note that my it is a bit late here and my eyes are very dry, so I apologize if I blink a lot because the air is just very dry. But I wanted to say that with respect to the European approach, I am very impressed by the ambition of the European Commission and different directorates general on many fronts with respect to AI. There really is a good faith effort to bring in many experts who are from various fields to comment on the long-term future of AI. And the Parliament, the Commission, the Council, all three branches in the European Union, each have generated very important discussion drafts and papers about how a broader European perspective on regulation of artificial intelligence could develop. Now, of course, I would like to see more red lines, and I realize that the European high-level expert group on artificial intelligence was skeptical of red lines, but I think there should be some clear red lines, and that was part of the idea behind my relatively simple new laws and approach to the issue. I think that looking at the UN, there is some promise there, and I think that there has to be an ongoing conversation, particularly as to lethal autonomous weapon systems and robotics, because I think that that's another area where the stakes are so high in that area. And so I hope to see that dialogue continue.
Thank you. I see questions coming from the audience. One question that maybe is coming from a researcher, maybe even a young researcher, is a question directed to you. What areas or topics are of special interest or need to be researched nowadays?
So the particular areas of AI research that I think are quite compelling are, I am trying to develop a vision of political economy in the book that is pushing toward AI that meets human needs, particularly in areas like in food, medicine, transport, logistics, manufacturing, and where I hope to see more emphasis on intelligence augmentation is in fields of the human services. So I think that with respect to forms of AI, one thing that seems to be quite promising but happening slowly is the analysis of vast quantities of research in fields like medicine. So I hope to see more assistance there to doctors on that level. But I think we also have to realize that where sometimes the most important additions to human welfare will not be coming via AI, but will be coming via social interventions. And one of the things that's so fascinating about, for example, the current COVID crisis is you have a emphasis among many techno-solutionists, people that think that solutions always come from technology, on apps that would be contact tracing or notifying people of exposures. And I think what's very sad about this in the West, particularly in the US and Europe, is that the app really was the third or fourth or fifth priority. The first priority was a really well-developed system of testing and contact tracing and support for quarantines and support for targeted shutdowns and for border controls, and just hasn't happened. And so I think that the main thing I would emphasize with respect to AI research is that I can't be the arbiter as to what is the most promising form of AI. But I can emphasize that in many areas, what would be more it's very important to first decide, is technology and AI itself the primary need here, or is the problem embedded in a larger social system where the first, second, third, fourth steps have to be taken by people entirely outside of technical fields?
C'è una domanda che può essere il seguito naturale di questa riflessione, perché una nostra ascoltatrice ci dice: ma gli obiettivi per lo sviluppo sostenibile delle Nazioni Unite non potrebbero aiutare a direzionare lo sviluppo dell'intelligenza artificiale nelle direzioni da lei auspicate? Ed effettivamente, se ci pensiamo, forse non c'è nessun SDG, nessun obiettivo di sviluppo sostenibile specificamente sul tema che abbiamo discusso oggi, però forse alcuni di loro possono contribuire a portare l'intelligenza artificiale nella direzione giusta.
I agree with you. I think that having sustainable development goals in this area would be extremely helpful. And I think that one example of that, that I find some inspiration from East Asia, is that in both China and South Korea, there are going to be textbooks for school children in AI. So our artificial intelligence methods will be part of the curriculum. Of course, the next step needs to be having the discourse about ethics, the ethical, legal, and social implications of artificial intelligence as part of that as well, right? But at least having that sort of be part of early education, you know, so people are experiencing and understanding these concepts in grade school as opposed to just coming into them in college would be very helpful, I think. I think also with respect to sustainable development goals in AI, it would be a very interesting thought experiment to grade and rate the most important artificial intelligence firms, the departments at universities that are doing the most in this field, to grade and rate them about to what extent have they, in a demonstrable fashion, actually met human needs. And I think that that type of environmental sustainability and green evaluation would go a long way toward improving our applications of AI so that they are not simply focused on rearranging claims to existing social bounty, but instead are based on the ability of the government and others evaluating the value of AI to reward truly productive innovations in the field.
Grazie. Una domanda da parte di qualcuno con un'attenzione alla letteratura, perché ci dice: ai tempi delle leggi di Isaac Asimov c'era paura che i robot, la paura principale era che i robot facessero, danneggiassero, facessero male alle persone. Mentre invece adesso sembra che la preoccupazione non sia più tanto quella, come se non fossimo più spaventati del danno fisico, ma siamo preoccupati del fatto che i robot possano prendere il nostro posto. Secondo lei, quali sono le ragioni di questo cambiamento, quasi culturale o di paure?
It's an excellent question. And I think that, there is a very important transition there. And I think that, in Asimov's laws, he was assuming the existence of human-like robots. And his idea was that this was just going to happen, by the mid-21st century. And that once it happened, our goal would be to try to make sure that the robots would be non-harmful, they wouldn't hurt us, and that they would be subject to human control. And I think the problem with Asimov's perspective is that first, you don't have to assume that a certain technology will develop. We have the opportunity to develop technology in directions that we want to. And so that I think is part of the hope for a new laws of robotics, is that we go in that direction. And secondly, what Asimov really lacked was the institutions necessary to keep people in control, right? So that's part of my emphasis on the professions and emphasis on legal interventions to direct the shape of technology development, is recognize that we do have this power, that we do have the ability to reward the most productive AI innovators and to punish those that are doing things that just seem to be either causing arms races or just wasting people's time. And so that I think is the key. And the point about being replaced is really important because there is this trap of automation discourse where people are talking about automation and the conversation goes, you say to them, they say, well, look, I've got a new robot lawyer. And then I say to them, well, you know, I've looked at the way your robot lawyer makes wills or last trusts for people to plan their assets or to plan how their assets would be distributed after they die. And it turns out you're missing this very important thing, right? So I can say that to them. And then they just come back to me and say, well, you know what? Thanks so much for pointing that out. Now in the second version, we'll include that, okay? And so the idea becomes that if everything you say to the maker of a robot to say, you did not capture what my job truly is or what I truly do, that becomes grist for the mill of the company to add that to the machine. And so I think that's why there's so much anxiety, right? Because the idea is that if there really were the possibility for computer science or some other field to just watch you and replicate whatever you do based on whatever stimuli happen to you, that's disturbing. That's a very disturbing idea. And it would go, I'm certain, it would go beyond the workplace to people in all sorts of other roles. And at that point, we're in sort of the Westworld type scenario where you do have the possibility of robots just wanting to or just inadvertently out-competing and even wiping out people. And so I think that that's the concern there. And I think that the anxiety about being replaced by a robot is well-placed. And I think part of the future for experts in the field is to help policymakers understand and help the public understand where should certain jobs simply be done by software machines and where do we want to instead make sure that there's a durable human presence.
Ultime due domande, poi lasciamo il nostro ospite riposarsi visto il fuso orario in cui parla. Abbiamo una domanda di un insegnante che ci dice che i ragazzi sono molto interessati e curiosi su questi temi e ci chiede un consiglio, lei chiede un consiglio su che cosa potrebbero leggere o guardare per cominciare ad approfondire questi temi.
Ah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that, you know, for children, or I mean, I will, with students there, I guess I should speak both to children and for older students. And I think that with respect to children, science fiction is often a really good route into thinking about the future rigorously. I think that with respect to college students, there's a book by Kathy O'Neill called Weapons of Math Destruction that is a really good analysis of the statistics and math underneath AI and robotics, right? And it might seem like something that's a little basic in terms of looking at mathematics and statistics as opposed to looking at actual like current AI and robotics right now. But I think it's important, and what she does is she really dramatizes, for example, the problems of teachers that are being evaluated by an algorithm or the problems of someone who can't seem to pass a test that seems biased against the disabled. And so that sort of thing is really helpful to dramatize the state of AI and robots in everyday life. I've just been reading, again, for college students, some novels and some science fiction is really helpful. And I've just been reading a book called Waste Tide, I believe by Chen Qu Fan, which is a really interesting take on the political economy of technology transfer between China and the US and back and forth. And I think that and another novel that I recently read was Ian McEwan's Machines Like Me. And I think Machines Like Me is a brilliant novel because it imagines what would it be like if we just were to sell robots that could just be your friend or just be someone, you know, you could always have nearby to do the dishes, to talk to if you're lonely, to do other things. And as the novelist, you know, a great novelist tries to sympathetically reconstruct and understand what it would be like to live with a robot, right? And not as a family member, not as a, you know, fake husband or wife, but just as someone that you just have around that could be both a maid and someone to talk to and someone to go and do errands for you, etc. He illuminates so many of the very difficult problems that would be raised by that scenario that are not really anticipated in a lot of the ethical or technical literature. So those are examples, but you know, I want to think further about this question because I think that there must be better ways into the topic. I do think that, you know, with the younger children especially, to think about how we interact with technology and the type of stories we tell about it, that's going to really matter to how technology gets regulated over time. So, thanks.
Può ripetere il titolo del primo libro che ha citato, il primo romanzo?
Oh, Waste Tide, The Waste Tide. It is for college students. I wouldn't recommend it for someone younger than college, maybe high school.
Okay.
But
Okay. One last question is probably from somebody qualcuno con un background giuridico che chiede, dal punto di vista giuridico, il fatto che la tecnologia evolva così rapidamente non pone un problema forse insormontabile, ovvero che sia difficile fare delle policy prima che la tecnologia si affermi? È un'utopia pensare che le norme possano arrivare prima dello sviluppo della tecnologia oppure è possibile?
I think it is possible. I mean, I think that it's really important. I think it's really important that we do this because it's really a matter of investment, of where you invest resources, right? And if we have a real investment in regulatory infrastructure, we can develop goals in technology fields. And I think another aspect of this is that some of these firms are just too big. You know, I mean, Facebook having both WhatsApp and Instagram and Facebook in one company, it's just too big. And so we have to sort of cut some of these companies down to size so that regulators are able to get there to fully understand what's going on in the AI and technology that they're developing. I do think that the question of speed is important, but I think that the answer to that has got to be investing more in and streamlining administrative and regulatory processes, and also being able to both make quick decisions about regulation and to be able to quickly extract oneself from them. And that's going to take a lot of dedication of resources. You may well have to see a world where people in the higher levels of regulation are making, if not the same salaries of people at the highest levels of tech firms, at least something that, you know, would keep them from just being tempted away from the regulatory field into a job at the tech firm, or rules saying that they can't do that. I think Singapore has rules like that, and there's a great book called Preventing Regulatory Capture. So all of that could help.
Bene, ringraziamo veramente di cuore il professor Pasquale per aver dedicato un'ora del suo tempo, della sua attenzione a Biennale Tecnologia, collegandosi tra l'altro anche un'ora tarda la sera, quindi grazie veramente di cuore. Ci dispiace di non averlo potuto ospitare qua a Torino, ma confidiamo forse per Biennale Democrazia, che avrà luogo nel 2021, di riuscirci, perché sarebbe un piacere averlo anche di persona a discutere, non soltanto con noi, ma anche con il pubblico e magari anche con gli studenti di cui stavamo parlando un secondo fa. Quindi grazie ancora della sua partecipazione e a presto.
Oh, you're welcome. It was an honor to be here. Thank you, Carlos. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Good night. Thanks.